So my research was specifically, or is still specifically, on how the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund work together. So I look at it, at instances of collaboration. Not everything that I say will thus be applicable to your research, but maybe you can take a few pointers or insight, or we have questions and conversations about how I did this or how I should have done this maybe, because there are always things you could have done better. So this is the purpose of the of this talk, is to engage in a conversation, to raise questions, so whenever you have one, just go. Also for us to reflect on how we want to do our own research, and you've just presented what you're all doing, and it's very diverse. Even though it's all probably be touching on some types of needs in some way, but there's different research if you go into an indigenous community than interviewing someone at a central bank. It's very different. What I'm saying applies to what I did. That was a series of semi-structured interviews, so very qualitative. I'm not doing, or haven't been doing surveys. It's not standardized, so I was asking similar questions, but not always the same ones. And it evolved flexibly. That may be just as a caveat when you try to infer or take inferences from this conversation. So interviews, well, how can you learn about interviews? I think one aspect is very important, it's field experiences. So as you do them, you get better and you learn. You learn from mistakes, especially from those that are brutal and that hurt you, because it takes you extra time to maybe... an example, if you forget to clear consonant in a particular... Let's say you have cleared consonant, as you should, but you've forgotten one little detail to ask that you only later realize should have been important, and you should have asked that to make sure that you can use it one way or another. And you only realize that after the 20th interview, you need to go back to the first 20. That's one of those mistakes that are costly and brutal, and that really no one likes to do that. But sometimes happens. So trial and error is another element of that. Advice from others, and I would specifically mention supervisors, of course, because at the end of the day, they will be kind of your role models in a way. But I would also seek advice from, as we do here, from peers, because one supervisor or two supervisors will have seen a lot of stuff, but a dozen students, roughly, will have seen a lot more taken together. And part of doing interviews is also common sense, linked to trial and error. So you find out stuff that makes sense for you after a year, maybe 2 years later, don't make sense anymore. So this is a very rough background of how you get into interviews. And I'll probably say that this what we are doing here is linking my field experiences, my experience from trial and error, with advice and some common sense. I'm trying to bring those four together as best as I can. The focus will be on the first two parts, which is preparing and conducting expert interviews, because there's so many ways of analyzing them that we can't even come from here. And that will critically depend on what kind of research you're doing, right? If you're interested in discourse analysis, you might do different types of analyses than when you are using these interviews mostly for background information, for information for what kind of reports are important for these actors. Maybe you're doing the interviews only to figure out what kind of internal documentation a particular set of organizational members actually read. Maybe just to make sure that you read the right stuff. Because when you, let's say, do research on the European Union, the IMF, and the United Nations, they produce so much, it's killing you. And what they produce also mostly, and feel free to keep that on, utterly boring. Because these reports are polished, like you should polish your own car or your floor. They're just perfect almost, right? It's very difficult at least to find it enjoyable to read hundreds of pages from an official governmental body or an international organization. It's not as exciting as reading a novel most of the times. When you conduct interviews, I think it's convenient, I do that here for the purpose of presentation, to distinguish between three phases, which is before the interview, during the interview, and after the interview. But that's just a rough guide. Very often you will see things are blurry and overlap. Sometimes what you do during the interview, maybe you can do after. It depends a bit, like note-taking or interpreting. It depends. When it comes to analyzing interviews, as I said, your best source of advice will be your supervisors and maybe the methodological literature, textbooks and articles, because it depends on your research question. So elites, what's so particular about them? And I've only mentioned three here. Maybe you have more ideas. I think one is knowledge, right? And that's the tricky part. Because most of the time, those people will know more than we do. Hmm. So let's say someone mentioned central banks, yeah? Even if you talk with them about gender, they will still know a lot more about monetary policy than probably all of us combined here. It is a challenge. I'm not saying it can't be done. It's just be aware that they know more than you. And be aware that some of them will go out on a hunt to demonstrate how much they know. And then this is where the common sense comes in. It's very difficult to give you like a rule of thumb. Sometimes you just have to bear it. And you, of course, have to prepare as best you can so that you seem knowledgeable enough. But you can't, you can never reach the level of someone's work at a central bank for 6 years by reading up on central bank issues. It's unlikely. Because they will know the organization plus the field. So this is a very interesting dynamic in elite interviews that you might not find to be as prevalent when you interview non-elites or what is called everyday actors. Positionality comes in there. That comes in most or all interviews, actually. But in this case, it is the dynamic between an academic and an organizational actor, for instance, government official, someone who has got a particular mandate and duty. And positionality also means, well, what kind of gender you seem to represent. Race, age, a lot of things come into positionality. It means, like, what kind of power do you have in that setting? And it's difficult to say, there's no general rule, but as a rule of thumb, when I go into the IMF, I think I'm at a big disadvantage, big advantage. I'm a white male. Most of them are white males. I'm not saying you shouldn't go in if you're not, but it makes it easier. And I might know a lot less than someone who's not white or not a male. But on the other hand, if I were to interview someone from China, maybe, Nash, I'm sure you would have easier access to them than I have. Because you not only do you speak the language, the same language, you also have acquired the cultural habits that I lack. So a lot of things, and they're intersecting. There's no easy way. I might find it easy to approach some of them, but more difficult with others. So be prepared that some people will be more difficult to handle for you than others. A lot of things come into play there. But be open-minded and look at how an interview happens and reflect on whom you got along with well and whom you didn't, and maybe what made that happen. Exposure is important. Elites are exposed. I mean by that they face a risk, reputational, job-wise. So most of them want to stay anonymous for that reason. It doesn't really matter whether you interview someone called Michael Smith or, I don't know, Regina Smith on the street. But interviewing the US president or an advisor to the US president makes a huge difference. So most elites will stay anonymous and they would expect you to treat them as such. And because they're more exposed, they will also be much more careful in what they say. They won't swear usually. My experience. And what they say, even if it's a criticism of something, will be probably delivered in a very nice way, in a particular language. And sometimes you have to decode it or find additional evidence in reports or from other interviews. Well, how do you prepare for an expert interview? Apart from like understanding who that person is that you contact. I'm not sure I did it the best way, but at some point you start asking people. And if you have, like, say, 10 or 20 people in mind you actually want to speak to the most, then don't ask them at first. Maybe ask other people and work your way towards them. Because you may use the other ones that are less important to you, if you actually can determine who is most important, sometimes you can't, to give you a reference so that you can actually contact the person you're most after. In large organizations, this is actually a challenge because you can't interview everyone. In small organizations, the challenge is how can you interview people without everyone else knowing that? So you need to know who's the interviewee. which means you need to know the context, the organization. Let's say someone mentioned the European Union. What kind of position does this actor have in the European Union? Or the IMF, a staff member or a country representative, makes a difference. And ideally, depending on your research, of course, but ideally you want to kind of cover a representative sample, even though it's, at least I try to, even though it's qualitative research, I try to speak to people from different regions, with people from in different positions in the hierarchy, so that you can like a sense of whether this is very different if you are a top-level manager or a low-level manager. Then you also should think about what's the purpose of this interview. Like, what specifically might you want to get from that interview? With the first 10 interviews, it might just be a matter of understanding what's happening. At least for me, that's what it was. I didn't really understand bank fund collaboration until my 15th or 20th interview. But at some point I realized, oh, now I know more than this person. I knew that they knew less than I did about a specific thing. At some point you know that, and that's a very good feeling to have. And then you also realize what kind of people know less because of their position. And that's the point where you probably have a clear purpose in mind, where you just interview someone to get this one question answered, and you build your interview around that. You may be interested only in, let's say, human resources in the European Central Bank hire women as opposed to men, and what their conception of a woman is, a female economist as opposed to a male economist. And then you target this particular human resources person, maybe someone who's published a paper on that point, and then you grill that person on that particular issue. It might also be more general, that depends. How would you make the first contact is very different in depending on I think the culture of an organization or an institution. So for TM, I can tell you IMF and WAPMI are very fine with being send an email, and our common supervisor also said that this is the way it could be done. In some cases, people might prefer to be called, even for the first contact. Try to find out what applies in your specific context, ideally by talking to other people who've recently done research on that. So anyone in World Bank IMF, I can tell you, their email address is as follows. It's the first letter of the first name, their full last name, @imforworldbank.org. Few exceptions, if you're called Michael Smith, you usually have a number after Smith because there are too many. Then it's more difficult. But so try to find out in your particular context how you get access to these people and whether they prefer emailing, calling, arriving at the office unannounced. I don't know. It depends. Several factors play into that, and I can't tell you which one it is. But it's very interesting to see how different organization and institutional context develop different cultures of doing that, of reaching out and connecting with the public. What do you say or write in such a first approach? Also very much dependent on your field. Unfortunately, I can't give you a clear rule, but don't be too charming to them. So don't say, well, with your wisdom, I would really benefit from your wisdom. Don't do too much. Show them by how you write that you know that they know something. You could mention that because you worked in this position at the United Nations for 5 years from 2002 to 2007, I would like an interview because I'm interested in what happened in 2005. This is showing them that you know, one, that you know whom you're approaching and that you do it on purpose, second. And third, you indirectly acknowledge that they know stuff, right? You don't have to tell them, oh, you're so smart. You don't. Because by saying that you know this and appreciating that they were in a critical, central policy-making position at that time, or still are, you show them that they matter, that they are important. I would always include some information on your research project, like very general. Hey, my name is, like, DS, or depending on the organization, maybe even hi, that depends. I am from the university of, doing my PhD there. Topic is at least something like that, but short and concise, and they can always get more if they want. Where do you meet? That's interesting. If it's a small organization, it might be better not to meet there. It might always be better to meet somewhere else. Might be better to meet in a cafe, even though the quality of taping might be a lot less good. I basically had a mixed approach where whenever, usually I would assume that Wellbeing IMF people are too busy to meet me somewhere else. So usually they would ask me, Matt, you can come to my office and we have a conversation. Some people were former IMF and Wellbeing people, so they didn't have an office anymore, they were retired. And I was lucky to have an office and a setting in a research center where I could use a spare office to do the interview, which is very good. Because then they are quite protected. No one sees us out in the open, so no one can affair that we talked. It depends. The more critical or the more dangerous the research is, let's say you're Secret Service stuff, probably you don't want to meet them in a cafe, because they wouldn't like that. It depends on personalities and also on their specific roles, especially if they're still active. So now we're at the stage where you have the interview, right? So Faisal has now secured the interview he's always wanted to interview, right? A bit nervous, but still confident. What I've always done is I bring a printed consent form. I have been in the habit of sending out the consent form by email once the interview has agreed on a particular time and date, which gives them time to read the consent before you start the interview. Because otherwise, you come on the day and you give them, oh, by the way, this is my consent form. And they say, well, oh, you didn't mention that. Now I have to read this? So they feel pressured to read it within 5 minutes, which is, I think, very precious time for you to do the interview. So send it to them, especially elites. Expect that. Mm-hmm. So I have one case where this person actually read it and said, oh, interesting. Oh, good. Yeah, I like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And another interview said, oh, you're very generous because I offered them to withdraw at any point. And I said, yeah, that might be true, but if you became the president of a particular country, not your country, and maybe you don't want to be included in the research, then one out of 80 interviews will drop out. What's the harm? And it gives them confidence that they can trust you and that you're reliable and doing your stuff well. In the worst of case, they would ask you, well, now I'm in an important position. Maybe they would then only demand, you can ask them, maybe instead of withdrawing, would you be happy not to be quoted, but can I paraphrase and take background information? They will probably say, yeah, that is okay, but no direct quotes anymore. Or maybe before they said, my name can be used, but now, no, can you please render me anonymous now? It might be more about that. It was more an attempt to open negotiation about how they want to do it, rather than saying, you need to withdraw. But it's an option, and if they demand it, and even if I, no one has done this, but if someone had done this, I would always have asked them, is there any other way we can do this, or do you actually want to fully withdraw from the research? But give them time to read it before. In some cases, like the IMF, usually the secretary will handle the email, and then they will forward it to the person you're talking to. But it's good to bring it on the day as well, because maybe they've forgotten to read it. Business cards, important. The university, at least our department, and WBS, I'm sure, as well, because where would you have business cards if not in a business school, right? It is good to have them, especially with elites, but even with non-elites, with non-elites, yeah, that could be tricky because that reinforces the power differences, maybe. But with elites, definitely have that. It makes you appear professional. They know how to contact you, their questions. And in many cases, just a habit. In international organizations, at least the ones I've seen, European Commission a little, and IMF and World Bank, it's just part of being a part of that community to exchange business cards. So, bring water. Don't expect them to feed you. They might not even offer you water. It's sometimes that bad, right? It also buys you crucial time. And it makes you appear to be interested enough but not completely focused on them. Sometimes it just makes you human and you need water. Especially if interviews take more than 30 minutes. Yes.
Sorry, we did provide one for you.
Dress appropriately. By which I don't mean to say
is this a slayer?
That I mean, I don't like actually people, I don't like if I'm told what to wear, but it helps your research if going to the IMF you don't wear sandals and shorts. Try to figure out what the appropriate dress is. So what I think in the context I've done interviews, it's debatable for someone who has male gender whether a tie is needed, but a suit and a shirt usually don't hurt. Probably rather help. In one case I remember, and feel free to keep it on the record, I had no shirt left and I forgot it at home and I only had a white t-shirt and I just put it under the suit. And it was a bit interesting, but norms in the IMF seem to be evolving, so that person also had the shirt like loosened a bit. So yeah, it depends. It can just be an unnecessary burden if they perceive you to be unprofessional just because of your clothing. As much as I don't, or I dislike this kind of judgmental thing, but elites can be very focused on such stuff. Well, that seems to be quite obvious. Bring paper and pen or pencil. I find post-its quite useful for one particular thing. If people recommend other interviews to you, other internal friends or colleagues, I like to write this down not below the interview notes, because then if someone found my notes, they could link these names to the interview and find out who it was. In the worst of case, if I lose my notes, I never write down specific names linked to an interview in my notes, but it will always be a flexible post-it that I then remove and throw away later. But that's just a personal preference. Well, if you tape, bring a recorder, of course. Spare batteries. I really was unfortunate at times, or unhappy, because my batteries were running out because the charger was not good enough. So it indicated fully charged, and then within 20 minutes it was down to nothing. So make sure that you've tried the material before, and so you avoid that. It happened to me twice, and that wasn't too good. It was okay because it wasn't too bad with those people, but try to not have it happen to you. Bring a microphone in case you do interviews in a more busy setting like a cafe. Sometimes putting the microphone between you and the interview will then increase the quality of the tape. Make sure you know where you have to go if you're not meeting on home turf. Contact details in case you need to send them an email or call them, unless you actually know where to go and it's no brainer. Bring a map if needed. And when you are hosting the interview, make sure that you have a quiet room where you're by yourself, just you and the interviewee or interviewees if you're having multiple. So that no one disturbs you, and that.
Yeah, can I ask? According to your experience, when you ask, can I record the interview, how do they react? Are they happy?
Some people don't want this, and then you don't. And some people say it's okay. And so what I've done now, and that was actually what I didn't ask before, if they agree to be taped, then I ask them, can I quote from the tape? And before I didn't, because I assumed by agreeing to be taped, they would also agree to be quoted. But some people agree to be taped but don't want to be quoted. Then you can only paraphrase them. Okay. And that's the thing I did not ask specifically in my first interviews, so I had to go back.
And if you need to take notes while they are talking, because they say please don't record, do you have any specific advice about
I think they should accept you taking notes. Even if they said no taping, I've had no one ever say you can't take notes.
No, but I mean, while taking notes, do you have any specific advice? Because I think it's a bit complicated. You're asking the question, he's replying, or she's replying.
Yeah.
You need to focus on what he or she is saying and also taking notes.
Well, if you can't tape, then probably you take more notes than if you don't. But I also take notes when I tape. Sometimes it's just like little things like reminders, or if I find something questionable. If they refer to this same neoliberal thinker all the time, I might know, likes Adam Smith quite a lot. What does it tell me? Something like that. Sometimes they mention a particular report, and then, that report I want to read. Stuff like that. I would probably taking a few notes is good, because it makes you feel, makes you appear to be naturally immersed in the content, so that not all the attention is on the interview. Yeah. So what do you do before the interview? We're still in the before phase, but no longer preparing or setting up. So when you're actually meeting, so Faisal is now in the room, right, in the tower of power, and speaks to the government official. I would briefly recap the research project, so introduce yourself and give them just one sentence on what this is about. I'm interested in understanding how the European Central Bank understands gender. I'm interested in understanding how the South Korean government regulates, was that media, social media?
Yeah.
Social media platforms. I'm interested in understanding X, Y, Z. My focus is on, you name it. Briefly clarify the conditions for the use of material, the consent that you've sent out before. You can ask them, did you understand everything that was in there? Or you could just simply ask, are you fine with that? Is what I gave you according to what you expected? Can we go ahead as planned? So if you tape, I would then tape the consent and ask them specifically, are you fine with being, can we proceed as discussed? I will tape the interview, I can quote, but I won't attribute it to your name. Is that fine with you? And they say yes, and then you start. So it's also on tape in case you didn't, you forgot to note it down. If you don't tape, then you can't. Then you just write it down. Sometimes it can be important to negotiate the proper label for an interview. Why is that? And I need to think how I put this because I don't want to reveal anything from my interviews. Okay, let's say. Okay, you have an organization with 35 people, but only one of them is a human resource manager. And you say, human resource manager of organization X said this. And they have a website where they have 35 profiles. And only one of them says human resource manager. Then this is as good as saying this person's name is. In which cases you should go for, let's say, staff member. It can be tricky sometimes, because especially when you quote or paraphrase from the material, also to use sequences where they didn't reveal too much about themselves. So sometimes you have to be careful. Also the IMF, interesting, right? It's 24 people on the executive board, and they have advisors. So I've decided to treat advisors as similarly to extra directors and alternates, because then it's 70, 80 odd people rather than 24. Because if it's country specific, it immediately becomes clear who it is otherwise. Sorry. So that can be important, but I would actually speak to them. What is the best flavor I can give you? Some people might have worked for the IMF and the World Bank, and then ask them, you want to be a former IMF staff member, a former World Bank staff member? What labor shall I give you? And they will know. Some people say, I don't mind, I trust you. You will do such that it doesn't hurt me. Some people say, yeah, staff member is good. Don't mention that I work for the other, just mention one. Switch on the recorder, tape consent, and off you go. Assuming that you tape, right? If you don't tape, then this is a bit less formal. Yeah, let it flow. As much as, the more they talk, the better for you. I don't have a percentage. I don't know if 10% of interviewer talking is too much or too little, but the more they talk, the better it is usually. Sometimes you might have to intervene and kind of direct them back on the path, but if they start a lovely episode and you might think this is completely uninteresting, let it flow. Especially in the beginning, because by listening you establish kind of what's called rapport and trust. You listen to them. Maybe they just want to be listened to. Maybe their partner doesn't listen. Maybe they only have a cat at home and no one listens. Maybe they finally want to demonstrate to the world that they know a shitload about X and Y. And you are there to listen. You have time, right? If they are not under pressure, then just make it 60 minutes instead of 45. Some people tell you, I have 45 minutes. And then you need to be more interventional. Then you need to be a bit more directing them. But otherwise, I always recommend letting it flow. Which is easy when you're shy, I guess, because then you let it flow anyway. But even with someone who's a bit more extrovert like myself, letting it flow is a good idea. You're bound to make less mistakes as well, because you don't talk as much, right? Some interviews have the curious habit of asking you questions then and to see how much you know. That's a bit uncomfortable. That's what I meant about the power and the knowledge differential that you face when you're meeting leads. But usually most interviews will be happy to give you an account. Of course, you need to probe and intervene, but only do it sparingly where you need to, where you absolutely need to. So listen well. That's one of, actually I was going to say that all of this is my own experience, but also advice from others that I got, from supervisors, from teachers. I remember that there was a DTC module, I think, where they said listening is probably the most important skill in qualitative interview research. It was one of the DTC modules 1 or 2 years ago, 2 years. I think they're right. Listen well. Ask sparingly where you need to. Encourage them and probe. Yeah, sometimes even leads want to be encouraged. It can happen. I haven't had really bad cases where you need to kind of, where people started crying or something, but sometimes they just want to be encouraged, maybe just nodding or demonstrating that you listen. And especially when you're not doing standardized research, try to ask questions differently. It's not standardized, so maybe it's better to ask them differently once you've realized that maybe they answer the same way if you ask them in a specific manner. Usually open-ended questions work best, so that they can't say yes or no, but have to enlarge and expand on what they're saying. Well, take notes to the extent necessary, and that depends on you as a researcher, your habits, your research agenda, your questions. So now the interview is finished. Faisal is really happy. He's done well. He's done well. I can see that. So tape is still on. You might now switch it off. Interviews is finished. Usually leads indicate when it's finished. I think in most cases they will tell you it's enough. It's probably better for you to show them that there is an end point. So what I think at some point started doing was saying, to sum it up, I've got a few final questions, or two final questions, or something like that. So this indicates that, okay, there's progression, we are moving somewhere, so they don't have to stop you. And then knowing that it will be finished soon, maybe they will even answer a third question. I'm not saying you should lie to them and say it's two questions, you actually have three, but if you say to come to the end, or to kind of zoom out to the big picture, they will know, okay, this is a signal, a signpost, that we are progressing and that we are moving towards the end. And then your questions might get larger again, not specific like, oh, what's this program about, but rather, where's the IMF moving to? What's happening in the ECB in terms of X and Y? It's important to thank them. There might be disagreement about whether you also need to send an extra email. I mean, you would, as a polite human being, always say thank you. Even if you disagree with them sharply, you can disagree so much with them. It's fine. You're still grateful for the time they took and the effort they made. I'm not sure if you need to send out emails. I first didn't, but then another researcher said, oh, you should definitely do that. I think that person had a point, because people then also say something like, oh, there's another interesting repo, or maybe you should talk to X and Y, something they couldn't tell you then because they had to leave, or they were busy, or they were stressed. So it's good, because then you stay in a conversation. And in a sense, the research doesn't end there, because you can still be in touch. I would recommend doing that. Draft an email and send out the same to everyone, but of course, under a different name. Maybe if you like them particularly, you can thank them and say, that was very helpful instead of just helpful. If they have time and don't kick you out, offer them the opportunity to reflect on what they have answered, what you've been saying, kind of a debriefing. Sometimes you can also test your own ideas in your argument and see whether they completely disagree. But do it after the interview. Don't do it during the interview, because then that will lead them in particular ways. And they might then disagree with you or be tempted to agree because it's socially more acceptable to agree, right? It's just more convenient, just nicer, right? Being in the same office fights are, of course, we always agree because it's just better, right? We don't need to be in a fight. And they might feel the same way if you present it to an interview. After the interview, it's a bit more like, oh, the tape is switched off, now we can talk more freely, and maybe they will give you additional confirmation of what you've been thinking. Maybe your hypothesis wasn't so bad after all. Or maybe they have additional ideas on that. And it's also an opportunity for them to ask specific questions. So I'm not sure how I did this, but maybe you can ask something like, do you have any questions, or is there anything that we didn't have a chance to talk about? That could still be in the interview, maybe, because that could relate to contents, but maybe they will then see this as an opportunity to also pick up on, oh, I would be interested in how you do this in the future, what are you doing with the research? So I always offer people to send them my publications once they're done, which I wouldn't do after every publication. You can group them, so you can do it every 2 years or every year, because otherwise it's a bit, like, you don't need to send out an email to them in May and in July again, but if you, after a good, successful year of publications in a few years' time, you have 2 publications, you might want to send them out. Even though some people might have moved, but then that's their problem if they don't get back to you and give you the new address. But many people will have stayed the same address, so yeah.
Quick question, yeah. Do you also do that with people you disagree with a lot?
Yeah, I've offered that to every single one of them. Yeah. And I'm sure that most people I'm involving will not agree with my research. Even though my PhD is not as critical as probably my other papers that I'm currently thinking about and writing, but yeah, why not? It also is a good opportunity for them, if they take engagement seriously, to think from a different perspective. And to put it bluntly, if you want to change the world, you need to know, you need to let those people who should change know what they should change, right? They can reject what you're saying. But if you want, let's say, the ECB to change their gender policies, they need to know about what's wrong with them. And most people won't take personal offense. So it might, of course, jeopardize your chances of getting future interviews down the road, but then there's so many things to do research on. Or other ways of, like, you could do to go to the archive of the organization, which they can't really reject. And people also move in and out, so that shouldn't be a really big, big, big problem.
I have a related question. I've been in situations in which I've been asked to either, like, share a draft of, I mean, in this case it was more about organizational case studies.
Mm-hmm.
So interviewers wanted to check on whatever picture I was going to paint of the organization to kind of check for accuracy and whatever.
Mm.
I've heard of people that offer to share transcripts with their interviewees to give the interviewees the chance to whatever, make corrections, rectify, just validate. I mean, is that something that you've encountered at all? Or
I wouldn't change a full exchange a full transcript, no. And no one's ever asked that. But I've yet to transcribe the interview. So, but they didn't say it at that point, so why would they now?
Yeah.
What some people say is, whenever you quote me or use what I'm saying, I want to check back. But that's different from giving them a full interview transcript. So let's say you quote person X twice. Then I would, in the draft, maybe cut out the full paragraph in which it is embedded and send forward that paragraph to the person. And maybe not the full draft of the paper, but only that specific paragraph. That's at least my take at the moment. So if someone from the IFK met, okay, use me, because they will have said, Matt, I want to check back. Some people do say that. So then I've indicated that, and if I use them, usually it's about quotes more than paraphrases, then I would give them a chance to review the paragraph. And then they could say, can I see a little more? And then I would have to think about it. But definitely I wouldn't allow them. You doing the interpreting, the inferences are yours. They can disagree and they can say that you're not painting the right picture. But it's about, the data is co-produced. So they have a right to see the way you use quotes and paraphrases. They have no right, I think, to interfere with how you interpret the evidence. That's for other researchers to make up their mind about and say, well, this is not done properly. But just because they don't like what you're finding doesn't give them a right to change it. But they do have a right probably a copyright or whatever you want to call it, on what they have said, and that you present it in a proper way. But only what they've said, not the inferences that you draw. But that's a fine line, right? Not always easy, I agree. I like the ECB gender thing, sorry, but if someone then said, well, the ECB is doing great on gender, and that these are the reasons, and that's why you need to change your article, that's going too far. Because where's the critical research gone now? If you're misusing their quote, they have a right to say you can't put it in this context. That doesn't make sense, if they ask for it specifically. If they didn't ask for it, I would still try to put it in proper context, always. Because you don't want to be accused after the fact. Once it's published, and then people start coming at you if they read it. You didn't do it right. This wasn't the context. But if the quote that you use actually is what they said, and the context in which you present it is fair to what they've said, and reflective of the conversation, without bending it or without deviating from the main message they had, then they can't disagree with you. They can disagree with you on the final conclusion, but they can't disagree on how you used it. That would be my take. But if it comes to that, then it's a specific case. Sometimes it might just be, then don't use that person.
Yeah.
So I have had a few people, especially one person, said, whenever you use anything from what we said, I want to see it. And I have other interviews that were more telling, and maybe I don't need that. Maybe I just use the interview, look at it, and think, okay, this is good background information, and it helps me to explore further, to find new evidence somewhere else. And it's always good to back it up with other sources, be it other secondary sources, research, or other documents, so that they can say, well, that's not true. Plan ahead. At the end of the interview, I think I first asked them whether they'd be interested in publications. And this is nice because I'm giving back. And then I ask them, do you have recommendations for other interviews? Whom else could I talk to? And this is tricky. Because what will a typical interviewer do when you ask that question? So I'm asking, so Faisal, I'm now the interviewer, and you're the lead, right? The lead actor. Would you have anyone else to recommend for an interview? What is your almost natural response to that?
I don't know.
Okay. Many people say, whom have you talked to so far?
Uh-huh.
And be careful. Why? Because you can't tell them. They can't know from you that you've interviewed Michael the day before. If Michael tells them, fine.
Is it ethical thing?
It is ethical, yeah. If you promise them to treat them anonymously, you can't reveal that you've talked to them. And I know it's difficult. Even saying no, at least I read that in a piece. You shouldn't do that. You should say, I'm not commenting on that. It's part of my rule of protection for them. The same rule applies to you. Because if you say no to A, and then they ask a different one, and you don't say anything, is that a yes then? I think this is about that. It's about, you don't reveal your sources, unless they have given you license to do so. It's a different case if Michael says, I'm fine, I recommend Susanna, and I'm fine if you mention my name in contacting her. She might then, Susanna might then infer that Michael was an interviewee, but there's no way of knowing, because you might have met Michael just for a cafe and not have had an interview. So I've had cases where people I met, I didn't have an interview with, but they recommended someone else. So people can't know for sure. But if they have allowed you to use their name for those particular three people, then you can. That is at least my... So don't review previous interviews, even if period, or future ones, of course, as well. But I think that's obvious. Don't reveal them. One interview, I remember, a very good interview, yeah, liked that person a lot, but it was interesting. I was given a name, and one that was difficult to spell for me, probably cultural background. I wasn't aware of how to spell the name. And the interview spotted how I was doing that. It's like, now, I can see you cannot have talked to that person. You don't know how to spell their name. It wasn't me revealing it. It was them inferring. I said, "Well, I can't say anything about it to that." It is interesting. They are very good. They are trained. But I think that's where ethics stop. I can't. What can I do? I didn't know how to spell the name, so I did as best as I could. And that person glanced on the sheet and could see I wasn't able to spell. Or maybe I said, "Well, was it an H?" Or I don't know. Yeah. So it can happen. We're all human, but try your best not to reveal anything. Yeah, and ask to use their name as a door opener. A door opener meaning, okay, I've talked to Faisal now, Faisal being the lead, can you recommend a few people? There's of course a risk in such snowballing because you might end up in the same network. But don't rely only on that. You can do both. You can follow up the snowball recommendations and you can do your own kind of selection. And if you square them and kind of triangulate them, then you don't end up talking to the same network. But it's a way of deepening your sample. And also, at some point, I realized that IMF World Bank Coalition is big, is huge. And I probably didn't specify it enough in the beginning, narrow it down enough, also because there's a lack of research on that, to know whom to talk to and what area I'm targeting. But after 50 or so interviews, the names that were mentioned became more and more the same. And for me, that was yes, yes, yes. And sometimes people mentioned names, and I thought, talk to, we'll talk to tomorrow. It was like I had spoken to those, or I had an appointment with those people. But I was still writing down their names to not show them that I wasn't interested in names, because then they could infer, well, he's talked to them already. Or I was just kind of doodling or whatever. But I would make sure that I still seem to be writing down their names. And it's very good if out of the 6 recommendations, you've covered 5 already. And the more this happens, the more confident you can be that this is a rather representative sample, as representative as qualitative research or interpretive research ever can be. But it's good. It makes you happy, because you know it's not so many more people. At some point, there's saturation anyway, and you don't need to follow up every single recommendation. You can't. Because one interview, 5 recommendations, you see how it's growing exponentially, at least until a certain threshold. Well, then after the interview, this is even after, it's analyzing them. Just very briefly, write down thoughts, reflections after the interview. Do it as soon as possible, ideally on the same day. Organize notes and records. Think about uploading transcripts and all that to a secure remote server that the university offers. If you have specific questions, I think it's called Storage Now or something like that. The good thing about it, it's secure. You can't lose it. The university can, but it's very unlikely. It's password protected. I actually use TrueCrypt, which just builds a container on your space. So there's a space within the hard drive that has a long and complicated password, random password, so that if someone steals my laptop, it's very little chance that they can access the interviews. I wouldn't do that for my draft of a chapter. If someone wants to steal that, well, if they've already stolen the laptop, the damage is done. But I would make sure that I protect the interview material a little better than that. Don't upload it to Dropbox, because Dropbox will, in doubt, always answer to US government. If the US government says you need to reveal, they will. That's actually when I stopped using Dropbox for a sensitive thing. I only upload like PDF readings on that since then. So the remote server is actually quite good. And you can use the same Warwick password that you use for your email, and they encrypt it, I think, here. And that's probably the best way of doing it, I think. And then you can access it from anywhere. In addition, it's basically a backup to what you have on your drive, but yeah. Summarize interview content in some way that's convenient for you. Some people like memos. I actually didn't do that, but I've done it now with those that I didn't take, because now I know what my research question will be specifically. So after 2 years now, I know exactly what my research question will be, and I hope it won't change much anymore. But at the time of the interviews, I would not have been able to do a good memo in terms of relating it to my research question, because it was just evolving too much. It depends, but definitely take notes, especially if they are untaped and you can't transcribe them.
So, I mean, it's going to be a process, right? You're refining your research questions as you do these interviews. Did you ever find the need to go back to previous interviews and ask for a second round now that you know what...
Not yet, but I might after the transcription, yeah.
Okay, and you find that that's something there...
Some people offer it. Okay. And those who did offer it, I noted that down as those are good interviews. They want to talk again. Like a handful out of those 80 maybe. 8 or 10 said that. I'll probably start with those. And also ask them, oh, I'm interested in this little one thing. Who's working on that? Who would you recommend? And then they can recommend, can I use your name? Yes, and then you could do that. But you wouldn't tell them if you actually went ahead and did it. Yeah. it depends on a lot of things, like timing, how much time do you have left in your PhD, and is it really important to make the argument, or is it more something for... But stay in contact with the interviewees, because you might want to turn your PhD thesis into the book. So maybe you're done with your PhD in 2018, 2019, roughly. At least the younger ones. And then the book will only appear in 2020, maybe, a year later. So you have another maybe 2 or 3 months to do additional fieldwork, then you want to get back to interviews. So make sure that you keep all the information up to date. But some people will have moved, which you discover then, but at least at the point of the interview, make sure that you have their contact details. Yeah, as I said, you can renew or revise your memos, you can do transcripts. Some people like to code, that depends. It's impossible to code 80 interviews, but you might want to code only specific things, like how do they perceive the other organization, and you code only one page out of each interview that's about that. Many, many ways to do that. That's indicated by the ellipses here. Maybe you need... Tian, you're good. Maybe you need additional interviews, and I didn't pay you to ask that question. Mm-hmm. Well done. And then you could go back and think about what else you need. So as you can see, it's kind of work in progress, and at some point you might be doing more transcriptions, and then you go back to your field, which can be a Skype interview as well. I've done those after. So when I left DC, which was in mid-July, I hadn't been able to talk to everyone because people from got back to me late, and in the end I was in the archives as well. I had two interviews a day and archival work. I was like, it was really stressful, it was getting too much. And then some interviews were still up for it. And I said, well, I'm leaving in a few days, but then you might want to do a Skype interview, or people were on vacation or traveling. And Skype interviews work as well. Especially once you have acquired the cultural knowledge of that institutional context. Once you know how they work and tick, then yeah. But bear in mind, if it's a Skype video call, still dress as you would in a face-to-face interview. I once remember, it was very early, I was just like basically coming back from sports, and I wasn't dressed like an IMF person would have been. And I got this call, and it was a video call, and oh no. And so I grabbed a sweater and just put it over. It was okay, but it wasn't like too professional. If it's a telephone call, of course, feel free to do it naked. Yeah. So just as a summary, see, this is a signpost. I'm telling you now that this is the last slide that really, really matters. That's another one that's not as important, maybe. So the challenges and promises of elite-focused research, and the challenge is, I was missing an R in hierarchy, I'll correct that before I send that around. So you learn to navigate the hierarchies, but it's a challenge, because different organizations or different bodies of political organizations work differently, and you need to learn to navigate those. You might encounter higher expectations as to how you should be conducting yourself, as to what you're representing and how you do it, in terms of what you know, and probably about knowledge mostly in terms of elite. And handling power differentials can be challenging. I remember one interview, and that was one of the most liberal interviews in terms of how much that person was going to reveal. But I, in the end, was queried about who my favorite political figures and all that are. And that wasn't comfortable, because it was challenging. You want to be honest, but you also want to not deviate too much from their saying. So you want to still keep it conversational without being dishonest, and you still don't want to be pulled too much into that. Luckily for me, that was a very nice interview, and it was really about just getting to know each other in the end. But yeah, you're lucky if you get that much time from an elite. Why is it promising to do elite interviews or elite focus interviews? Because most experts are elites in some way or another. You learn to understand how an organization works. You gain insights into professional culture. Good example of this is, so when you go to the IMF, I only have these two as really good examples, but you go to the IMF, there's a clear sign that says, visitors need to be accompanied at all times. And they take it literally. So some of the more liberal people actually allowed me to go downstairs in an elevator myself. Some of them actually would go with me and carry me to the door. and show me the door. In the World Bank, by contrast, you come in, and good luck finding the office. No one picks you up. Very few people do. And you can get lost because this is a massive building. It's interesting, right? I'm not saying that solves my research agenda or my question, but it is interesting. And it links well with a lot of research that says that the World Bank is less hierarchical and the IMF is heavily hierarchical. It's a very good, like, auto-ethnographic... it's a good piece of auto-ethnography. And it's a little insight that can help you understand how an organization works. And maybe will help you to interpret the material in a particular way. It's a small thing, but it can be good. And you have first-hand experience that you get from people who actually were doing this. So someone mentioned responsibility for taking, was you, right? You may be able to talk to people who are still involved in it or were, and this is probably more direct than reading a book from some other academic about how it's done. This is a very direct way of acquiring knowledge. Of course, with all the problems, they might present it in a light that suits them. Maybe they were the good guys, right? People everywhere want to be the good guys. IMF people, World Bank people, they want to be good guys. It's a question, and good girls, whatever genders we have. But the question is not whether they are or not, which is debatable, but it's important that they think they are. So they will present themselves in a particular light. Even if it's something as difficult as, say, structural adjustment programs, they will find ways of justifying that. Or if they've learned from it, they will find ways of justifying how they've learned from it. But it's very interesting. You don't need to agree or disagree, and don't do it in the interview. Don't tell them, oh yeah, you're right. Don't tell them, what? Right? Try to keep it analytical, and then you can disagree later on when you're doing the writing. Then you can disagree with their statements and back it up with other sources. So as most of you are still about to do the research, unlike us older people here, I'm the only 30 here, right? Or is that not? No, Nash as well. So, yeah. But most of you will be going into the field, and we might be continuing a little. I would ask supervisors. They will give you very targeted advice if they are good supervisors and pay as most people are, as far as I know. Ask other students to exchange experiences and discuss the challenges that you've encountered. So things like this here, or even one-on-one, because we're not that many, even though it's a good turnout for Crips. Feel free to send an email if you have any specific question or want the slides. My email address is on here, there, right? This can be a good way if you have specific questions to kind of continue the conversation to the extent that we can't do everything here. Training workshops can be good if you have specific training needs or want a particular skill to develop a particular skill that you need, maybe for analyzing interviews, or maybe all your interviews will be on a boat and you can't swim yet. I would learn swimming first. It's not a good example, but I think you know what I'm getting at. It can be analytical or very practical. Things that you might want to learn before you go into the interviews. And then, of course, there's always literature, too much to read everything, but maybe you want to pick a few textbooks or articles that apply something that you want to do in a particular but different context, and you want to transfer to what you're doing, and this will give you kind of leverage, analytical leverage, to talk more authoritatively on your particular approach to studying elites. And this has been a long way of saying it's fun and but challenging. And I think we could now switch off the tape.
Yes.
Do we have more time for questions?
Yes, we have around 15 minutes.
Okay, and then we can continue over drinks.
Over drinks, definitely. Stop. No, it's not.
Sorry, we took a little longer. But...